non-LSE person to chair this occasion. I'm William Twining, I'm from UCL. When I arrived at UCL more than 12 years ago, I was the only professor of jurisprudence in the University of London. Today we can count at least 12 full-time holders of chairs in the university who claim an interest in legal theory, and of course, many other colleagues, full-time and part-time, who do the same. Some of them are here today. It's a matter of interpretation whether all these professors can legitimately claim that what they're professing is jurisprudence, or indeed, that what they do is profess. However, there's no denying there's a vibrant pluralism in legal theory in this university today. Traditional positivism, liberalism, natural law, Marxism, realism, sociology and anthropology of law, Bentham studies, law and economics are all represented. So are feminism, critical legal studies, deconstruction, psychoanalytic theory, legal pluralism, various forms of postmodernism, law and literature, and systems theory. Profusion of flowers has bloomed along with some weeds, brambles, chaff, and wild oats. But perhaps the most prominent new arrival is today's speaker, Günther Teubner. Whether he's a rose among thorns, a sunflower among wallflowers, or a burning bush is also open to interpretation. But in the short time that he's been with us, he's already made a distinctive impact, and he's indeed a very welcome addition to our intellectual scene, carrying on the great LSE tradition of maintaining close links with German scholarship and thought. Günther Teubner was born in 1944. He studied law and legal sociology at Göttingen, Tübingen, and Berkeley. He's held chairs at Frankfurt, Bremen, and the European University Institute at Fiesole, as well as visiting appointments in several other leading universities. He's the author of 7 books in 3 languages, in addition to editing even more volumes. And he is, of course, best known as the leading exponent of autopoiesis. I don't intend to explain what that is to you now, and it's unnecessary. So it's my great pleasure to invite Professor Teubner to deliver his inaugural lecture on the theme, with the Latin title, despite recent prohibitions, Altera Pars Audiata, Law in Conflict with Other Claims to the University. Professor Teubner.
Thank you very much for this friendly introduction. I guess burning bush might be wrong. Hot air might make more sense. And you know why. I must warn you, perhaps within 2 or 3 seconds, the alarm bell will go on here in this building. It happened already 3 times to me. The first time when I gave my first public lecture here, the second time when I was interviewed by a number of 10 black people, and the third time when I introduced Niklas Luhmann to a discussion, it was always when I started with, you know, something in Greek or Latin that those alarm bells went on. And again today, so please watch out and don't worry, it just has to do with myself and not with real terrorism or fire. So ultra pars audiatur, law in the collision of discourses, no alarm. Perhaps somebody has got socialized, might be me or somebody else. Let me please start with a quotation by the grand old man of legal theory, Max Weber. It is like the days of old, when the world was full of many gods and demons, only different. It is like when the Greeks made sacrifices to many gods, one time to Aphrodite, another time to Apollo, and above all to the gods of their hometowns. Only today the magical and mythical is missing from the same conduct. It is fate that reigns supreme over all the gods and their struggles, and definitely not knowledge. Today, the only god left to whom law is supposed to make sacrifices is called rational choice. Over the past 30 years, a quasi-religious movement has spread through the Academy of North America with a particular zeal. After its high priest, Richard Posner, announced the demise of law as an autonomous discipline, economic rationality is supposed to represent the new monotheism of law. Theory of transaction costs, theory of property rights, public choice, and economic analysis of law are different currents in the broad stream of one movement, which is intent on replacing the emaciated concept of justice with the ideal of economic efficiency of law. This new monotheism speaks with the pathos of natural law in the name of both nature and reason. The internal laws of the market and of the formal organization are the nature of modern society, and law has to reflect them. The philosophy of rational choice elaborates on the principles of reason in this new order, and they apply to law as well. Law and economics claim to be the new victorious paradigm which eliminates older moral political orientations of law. And it does not tolerate the coexistence of any other paradigms alongside it. Thou shalt not have none other gods before me. Law and economics justifies its exclusivity with its historic victory in modern society, with the society-wide and today almost worldwide institutionalization of economic rationality. But here at the same time is the weakness of this movement, because it does not have this privilege alone. There has indeed been a paradigm shift. However, it is heading in a totally different direction. It is not the case of eliminating moral political monotheism in favor of economic monotheism, which law needs only to reflect. Rather, it is the case of a change from monotheism to polytheism, from the monotheism of modern rationality to the polytheism of the many discourses. There's a paradigm shift to the particularistic rationalities of the many gods, to which law has to respond in other ways than by just adopting a new god. Apart from economics, it's above all politics, science, technology, the health sector, the media, the law itself, and possibly also morality of life roles, which have all individually developed their own self-centered rationalities. They all expose a strange contradiction. On the one side, they are clearly particularistic rationality. On the other side, they are all institutionalized, in effect, society-wide, and all they demand universalistic acceptance. In this way, the cost-benefit calculus of economic rationality is only institutionalized in economic transactions. However, economization takes hold of the whole society. Rational choice makes the claims in all social contexts, and accordingly, rational choice also demands law's obedience, efficiency instead of justice. The same is true for political rationality. Democratic legitimation of power is typically only institutionalized in the political context. Nevertheless, the ideal of democracy demands society-wide acceptance and accordingly realization in law. Democratic legitimacy today is seen as the only valid foundation of law. Again, the core of scientific rationality, the uncompromising search for intersubjective truth, is essentially only institutionalized in teaching and research. However, scientification is a society-wide process which forces even the law to take a scientific approach in its regulatory aspirations. Finally, moral criteria develop typically only in small-scale interactions as evidence of mutual esteem. Nevertheless, morals, especially in their academic form of philosophical systems of ethics, want to regulate all social, today especially ecological issues, and request a hearing on legal issues as well. If all those belief systems were only airy-fairy theoretical constructs, mere philosophical abstractions, then law could easily reject their claims for universality as merely academic. However, the many new gods do not just create feigned theologies. They exercise a firm power grip in concrete world regimes. Max Weber's iron cages, or should one say today, computer networks of a new submission, have their foundation in social practices themselves. These universal regimes of particularism have five characteristics of social effectiveness which render their influence on law well nigh irresistible. First, their material base consists of manifest social practices on which the distinctions of the various universalities are inscribed. Markets and business organizations, elections, political associations, government, opposition, research practice, technologies, information systems of the media, agency of the health and security systems, all demand from law specific regulatory measures which have to reflect the universal principles of particularism. The modern plurality of gods is not a matter of individual belief of you and me, but it is a hard social reality which is forced inexorably upon law. To the detriment of its effectiveness, law has to abandon the simple model of threatening disobedient subjects with sanctions and must reformulate its norms as to match specific constraints. Neither are these social practices mere conventions brought about by the typical economic, political, scientific motives of actors. Rather, the many gods have created each their own theology, elaborated social abstractions in the form of self-concepts and reflexive theories, which in turn control and rationalize the practices. As we said, they are bold enough not to respect their own boundaries. Each of these partial reflexive theories claims to be accepted as the one and only one universal rationality. Economic theory claims to be the valid theory of society, which interprets society as a giant network of cost-benefit calculations. The same applies to political theory, which in its turn reduces society into conflicts of interest and power between groups and political aggregates. And both reflexive theories are not only restricted to cognitive issues, rather they develop normative dimensions and especially concepts about a just society, so they compete as political justice or economic justice with a specific legal justice. And beyond economics and politics, sensitive observers have discovered other spheres of justice in many social domains which proudly present their own autonomous concepts of a non-legal justice. 3. The many gods have even taken residence in the inner sanctum of law in legal theory and jurisprudence. Of course, political theories of law are not new. There's a long tradition of concepts of law from the perspective of political sovereignty. Today, however, political theories of law have experienced an extraordinary radicalization, starting with old German Freirecht and American legal realism, the international movement of law and society, and more recent critical legal studies movement to feminist jurisprudence and critical race theories. In their way of destructing the legal in law, they are only surpassed by recent economic theories of law. Law is politics is the war cry of critical legal studies, but is now drowned out by the war cry law is economics. As if this were not enough, we can hear today a crescendo of aesthetical anti-rational theories of law announcing the ultimate deconstruction of the legal proprium. 4. Legal practice itself has not been spared by the plurality of the gods either. Politicization, moralization, scientification of legal practice have profoundly changed methods of judicial decision making and their use in legal doctrine. Although the results are strikingly different, the new method is always the same. The law plays society. Legal decision making is invited to play act. Legal reasoning is supposed to simulate the practices of other social subsystems in order to produce socially adequate norms, which do reflect the inner logic of law's social environments. Some examples: balancing interests as a judicial method, and the instruction for judges under Article 2 of the Swiss Civil Code are typical simulations of the political process. The predominant purpose orientation in legal practice and the regulatory spirit of modern law necessitates simulations of scientific technical behavior. The appeal to community values asks for a simulation of moral universalization. And finally, the model of the hypothetical contract situation simulates economic behavior. 5. The most powerful weapon yet of the new polytheism may be the creation of an array of various independent machineries of social norm production, which produce legal norms directly from outside the law, from the various subsystems of society. With the help of these machineries, heterogeneous particularistic rationalities and their normative claim infiltrate massively the law, which has little control over them. The most productive extra-legal rulemaking machines, which is driven by the inner logic of one specialized social domain, are installed in various formal organizations and in processes of standardization, which are competing today with the legislative machinery and the contracting mechanism. In the light of their massive operations, the question as to whether or not law should remain pure as against the contaminations of particularistic rationalities has long since been decided. It is no longer a question as to whether or not, but only as to how. Max Weber analyzed modernity as the era of absolute polytheism. Parallel historical processes of rationalizing different value spheres have led to insoluble conflicts between the many gods of modernity, between depersonalized powers of belief, which cannot be resolved or removed through reference to the one reason. These conflicts, Max Weber submitted, have to be endured, have to be suffered subjectively and individually. We have to live through these conflicts in a chain of ultimate decisions. The contemporary discussion has elaborated in more detail the grammars of the language games and analyzed more accurately the social practices at their roots. Today, at the provisional conclusion of the debate, we find François Lyotard's distinction between litige and différend of the discourses, Niklas Luhmann's plurality of closed self-referential systems, and Jürgen Habermas' normative propositions as how to resolve discourse collisions. From these perspectives, the conflicts to which law is subject today are not resulting from colliding ideal values, but from colliding real social practices with their own logic and with an enormous potential for self-inflicted mutual damage. Recent theorizing has produced more than mere refinements and greater detail. Contributions from above all system theory and deconstructivism have radicalized Max Weber's proposition of a new polytheism in all its three dimensions: plurality, God, and conflict. First, the Weberian diagnosis of plurality, the assumption of a social polycentrism, is still too harmless. Polycentricity still maintains the comforting assumption of an ultimate unity of context, in which various actions of, in various centers of action coexist, as it were, the Olympus of the gods. It is replaced today by a more threatening polycontextuality, that is, a plurality of mutually exclusive perspectives, which are constituted by the closure of the discourses and which are not compatible with one another. Second, Max Weber's many gods, who even after secularization still represent basic authorities in the sphere of values, are replaced today by strange paradoxes which lurk at the foundation of social discourses and threaten to paralyze the observer. Quasi-religious value as the basis of a discourse has given into paradox what Derrida calls the new fondement mystique de son autorité. Third, the severity of the conflict between the gods appears to have dramatically increased. There's no longer a competition between different value systems. In the contemporary view of discourse collisions, the struggle of the gods has assumed almost self-destructive proportions. According to Lyotard, discourses are so hermetically closed that they deny each other the right to be heard and only do violence toward injustice to one another. According to Luhmann and Habermas, social systems have developed such powerful internal dynamics that they not only overburden individuals and harm the ecology, but also have disintegrating effects upon each other. Truly, the struggle between the new powers of belief produces a tortuous society, if not a tortured society. Therefore, we are faced with legal pluralism in a rather radical sense, a plurality of incompatible rationality, all with a claim to universality within a modern legal system. Different particularistic rationalities have formed bridgeheads within the law from which they operate in the designing of incompatible legal concepts. Given the situation, the temptation is there that law empire gives in and hands over the unity of law to one of those bridgeheads. Such colonialist claims come today from an economic, political, moral theory of law. But the question still remains, how can the law decide between them if each of them is legitimately institutionalized in social practices, and if each of them can demonstrate a universal rationality? Or to put it more strongly, is it possible for society to protect itself against self-destructive tendencies of colliding discourses by giving preference to one of them? Is it not, on the contrary, plausible that these self-destructive tendencies are increased by a preferential treatment of one of those discourses? A counterposition to privilege would be to refuse such a momentary decision of faith and the sacrificium intellectus connected with this, and to accept the controversial plurality within the law and to see it as an opportunity rather than as a sign of decay. The question then, whether such a plurality of legal ontologies, juridical concepts, and legal models has to be avoided, or whether one can cope with it. Does the pluralization of the rationalities of law necessarily lead to relativism and nihilism? Or can it not be turned around constructively? This would be the issue of accepting the permanent conflict between ontologies within the legal system as such and without the possibility of ever deciding it. The idea would be to maintain conflict or even to increase conflict, not to reduce it. Is there not a case for finding ways and means to increase the plurality by civilizing the conflict of discourses and to use its rich tapestry of conflicts productively? My suggestion is to work out the concept of a new law of conflicts. This is new because it refers to the old law of conflicts, which was a law that had to decide between different national regimes. Here, the new boundaries are defined by symbolic codes and programs delineating discourses and are not made up of territorial boundaries. Is there something to be learned from the historical experience with international conflicts between laws for dealing with the conflicts between discourses and systems? The classic international law of conflict is full of collisions which cannot be resolved by reference to a hierarchy, is full of circular references and self-references and paradoxes, which all have to be coped with in one way or the other. So there may be a case for fruitful analogies for a law of interdiscursive conflicts. The traditional international conflict of law can be seen as a vast network of references to foreign law and references back to the domestic law. The relevant technical terms here are called choice of law, qualification, assimilation, ordre public, internal and external consistency of decisions, and renvoi as the back reference to the domestic law. These terms provide a legal form for oscillating between inside and outside, for blending the foreign with the familiar, and for the game of confusion between self-reference and heteroreference. And in particular, it is the renvoi, which is the reference to a foreign legal order referring back to the local legal order, which has always fascinated legal scholars in conflict of laws by the very nature of its paradoxical circular structure. Should the renvoi be prohibited, or could it be made productive by introducing appropriate distinctions? Now, if legal theory could search into this direction, it could play an entirely different role in the game of references. It would definitely get away from merely endlessly pitting a political theory of law, a moral theory of law, an economic theory of law against a legal one, and calling one of them the ultimate one. Instead of trying once more to declare one of those rationalities to be the very deepest foundations of law, jurisprudence should develop a theory of discourse collisions which calibrates law to the plurality of social rationalities straight away. So the specific mission of legal theory would be to reflect upon the infinite game of references played out between a plurality of observation posts and upon its translation into constitutional form. Will such a constitutionalization reformulate the classical compensatory task of law in new context? Will a constitutional form for the conflict of discourses be able to curb self-destructive dynamics? Or at the very least, will it counter them with some measures of compensation? In the old interpersonal conflicts, the classical task of law has been to guarantee the mutual acknowledgement of autonomy, to curbing mutual infringement, and to compensate for mutually inflicted harm. Is there a way to translate those classical concepts into today's interdiscursive conflict? I would like to distinguish between two ways the law is dealing with the conflict of discourses. One is before the forum internum of law, the situation where the conflict of discourses is incorporated in the operations of the internal forum of law. And the other situation, the forum externum, where the conflicts are externalized into different social discourses. And in both situations, I would like to ask the question, what kind of normative perspectives are opening for the question how the law can deal with the conflict of discourses? I would like to use two examples. In the case of incorporation, I would like to deal with a type of legal reasoning, namely legal consequentialism. In the case of externalization, I would like to deal with the institution of the so-called ethic committees. And in both perspectives, I would like to ask the question, is it possible to counteract the imperialism of one particularistic rationality by counter-institutions in the fabric of social discourses? In the case of incorporation, the law uses its local rationality to treat the collision of discourses equal or unequal. That is the question with which new constellations are absorbed by law by subsuming them under a local rule. In order to answer this question, law incorporates incrementally, ad hoc, and eclectically some of the arguments provided by other discourses. Here it is quite crucial that law does not accept as a whole the method of universality from morality, the issue of identity from ethics, the goals-means relation from pragmatics, the cost-benefit logic of the economy, and the policy method of politics. Rather, law collects from those conceptual edifices individual pieces ad hoc, which are then fitted in its own construct according to the blueprint of equal treatment. In the relentless search for criteria for the distinction of equal versus unequal, the legal discourse is scanning its discursive environment, borrows ideas, rules, and principles where it can, and exploits moral, ethical, pragmatic arguments. However, the important point is that it transforms them all into legal criteria for the assessment of equal and unequal. So against what Jürgen Habermas is saying about the law, we do not see here a free play of discourses in the forum of law, but find that external rationalities are literally enslaved for the purpose of the legal system. François Lyotard introduced the distinction of litige and différend in order to define that slavery. Discourses are closed off from each other because of their different internal grammars in such a way that in the case of a conflict between them, no litige is possible, and that means no fair trial in which both parties can make their cases authentically, and in which a just decision can be made. Nonetheless, discourses can meet in spite of their hermetical closure, but only by way of a différend, that is, a confrontation in which one discourse perpetrates structural violence on the other and commits injustice. Just as in the international law of conflicts, a domestic court does not apply foreign law authentically, legal discord does not at all of a sudden act in an authentic manner morally, ethically, scientifically. Indeed, re-entry in the terminology of Spencer Brown is the term which captures the remarkable transformation of foreign concepts into legal conflicts. An original concatenation of distinctions separates through their operations the legal system from the environment, what is legal from what is not legal. Legal operations cannot reach out into their discursive environment, and as a result, law can only reconstruct its environment internally through closed self-referential operations. This internal reconstruction of the external world is never identical with the events as they happen in the external world. Even if the substance appears to be identical, they are different because they are recontextualized. For example, at the very moment that law reconstructs moral arguments internally, they lose their relation to the criterion of universality and to the moral code. They are now subjected to the mechanics of the equal-unequal treatment, pressed into the programs of law, rules, principles, doctrines, and ultimately linked to the binary legal code. Similar calculations of costs and calculations of power policy arguments, scientific constructs, they all are treated by the law in the same way. They all become strange hybrids, which are now, however, the sole responsibility of the legal discourse. The most important effect of this enslaving is that what could not be compared before can be compared now, or what could not be decided before can be decided now. However, and this cannot be stressed strongly enough, this effect works only within the symbolic territory of law. Law does not assume the role of a super umpire of the grand society game. It can only compare discourses within the legal game, and that only in a local way. So moral maxims, ethical identities, pragmatic recommendations, economic cost considerations, policy strategies all undergo a remarkable process of transubstantialization. After their re-entry, they appear as mere components of the legal discourse, as legal values, legal principles, norm purposes, interests for decision making. So this is not a case of the moralizing or politicizing of the law, but it is, on the contrary, the case of the legalizing of moral, economic, political phenomena, with the effect that their discursive differences become neutralized. In this way, perspectives of efficiency, effects of policies and moral principles can be offset against each other in each case, but to repeat, only insofar as the internal realm of legal discourse is concerned. An ingenious solution, indeed. Of course, legal practice invented it, and not legal theory. But there's a price to pay for it. This is not only the trivialization of high cultural achievements which become legal petty cash. Far worse is a loss of reality which comes along with making elements of social discourses the slaves of law. Law seems to lose contact with social reality by enslaving it. Precisely by making contact with the social reality. However, what does that imply for the acceptance of the decisions in the large world of society? It seems that with the re-entry, the problem of internal consistency, that is, the problem of the coherence of its own order, is solved satisfactorily. However, what about the external consistency, the acceptance in the external order? The ingenious solution of the re-entry into law is not reflected in the environment of law. It may even result in environmental damage as far as the other discourses are concerned. Perhaps then the ecologization of the law of discursive conflicts is the point where legal theory can inform legal practice. The re-entry has cut off the law from referring back to society rigorously, far too rigorously, and has cut off with that its sensibility as far as society is concerned. Is there not a case to be made that law should develop conceptual sensors as to whether or not its treatment of collisions has harmful effects on its social environment? Should the law not be concerned as to whether or not its well-meaning conflict decisions are inflicting damage on the social environment? Should one not here introduce once more the circular reference of the maligned renvoi in order to give law a base in society? I would like to examine this general argument using an example from legal methodology, namely consequentialist orientation in law. Today, lawyers make as a matter of routine decisions to be contingent on their actual outcomes. They do so even though they know, at least could know, that this cannot work. However, lawyers have hoped that concrete empirical findings on the causal consequences of legal decisions will lead to general models, which will warrant predictions as to judicial actions. These predictions, in turn, could then be translated into legal argument for or against a concrete decision. However, there are new doubts in sociology as to the prognostic capacity of the social science, which undermine a consequentialist orientation in legal decision making. These doubts extend to the fundamental principle of scientific methodology. There are now theories in the natural sciences which categorically deny predictability in certain constellations, even if events are fully determined and all laws governing them are well known. A second problem for consequentialism in law has to do with the infinity of the concatenation of causal outcomes. According to Luhmann, a form for legal consequentialism has to be found which does not increase the variety of law to such an unbearable degree that the functioning of law is put at risk. The challenge for law is to find new forms of redundancies which remain in law, having regard to the resulting increase of uncertainty in decision making. In my opinion, we must relate this argument to the collision of discourses. The relevant consequences of modern law are today no longer experienced in the diffuse life worlds of the subjects of law, but in the other specialized social subsystems where decisions of legal discourse are translated through a new form of reentry. Only after such a translation has taken place can it be detected in law whether a legal decision can be tolerated in the other discourses or whether it inflicts negative, disintegrative, or even destructive effects. Altera pars audiatur. This means that not only must the other party involved in a trial in an individual case be heard before a legal conclusion, but also that the other discourse involved has to be heard before the legal discourse can make a decision on the collision of discourses. With the help of a back translation, law should be made capable of receiving the specific linguistic form of such translations and their possible damaging effects. Law should make use of the sociological findings that in social discourse, legal norms are not just read as expectations of the law addressed to them. Rather, legal norms are reconstituted economically, politically, in a second reading by the respective discourses. And a legal observation of the consequences of decision should now, by way of a third reading, limit the relevance of the in principle infinite consequences to the few but decisive consequences with a negative impact on the law's discursive environment. Translation matters, not causal chains. How is the legal norm translated into the other concrete discourse? How is the re-entry of the legal decision into society worked out? What does the second reading of legal norms look like in other discourses? Does the legal norm have negative, disintegrative, destructive effects? And further, how can the legal discourse respond in a third reading with new norms which take its social environment into account? This should be, in my opinion, the search and find formula of a realistically defined consequentialist orientation. Of course, one cannot help realizing that law's cognitive resources are considerably strained, if not say overburdened, in this intricate game of renvoi by internalization of collisions and observation of their consequences. Unquestionable, it is somewhat demanding to ask us down-to-earth lawyers who are trained in case analysis to demonstrate multilingual attitudes which help us to reconstruct the language games of economics, politics, and ethics within the language game of law. Then it's even more important to focus attention on other fora in society outside the law in which conflicts between discourses are taking place. What can law contribute to this external treatment of the collision of discourses? Here, our attention is drawn to autonomous social fields of rulemaking in which different social universalities are directly expressed in legal form. As I mentioned before, there was the historical example of legislation and contract, and today a number of other plural sources of law have been developed, especially rulemaking in formal organizations, in technical professional standardization, and other forms of private justice. The trick is always the same. Transactions, economic exchanges, political acts, management decisions within organizations, and acts of standardizations are misunderstood as legal actions and perceived in law as contracts, statutes, associational laws, and technical or professional standards. Thus, without going into the details, law can attain an implicit knowledge about the particularistic rationality of the social sector involved. However, in this ongoing practice of social rulemaking, law is prepared to make sacrifices to the one God only, and is therefore at risk of losing its polytheistic virtues. Is there a chance that law regains this virtue if it focuses attention on discourse collisions arising in those rulemaking autonomous social fields? According to Rudolf Diethölter, an intricate interplay of autonomy and heteronomy is required. Autonomy, understood as a self-determination of social discourses, needs to be respected by the law, and at the same time, heteronomous control by the law will be exercised, but not as outer-directed, rather as a possible help in the situation of impossible self-help, a meiotic situation not unlike counseling and mediation arrangements outside of law. Can this subtle game of autonomy and heteronomy be institutionalized? Again, I refer to an example, and here I use the ethics committees in the broadest sense, which are currently one of the political most exciting experiments. Perhaps less so for the national top-level ethics committees, which work out general rules, and is much more acute for the small local ethics committees in hospitals, business firms, and universities, which review problematic decisions. In our perspectives, these decisions are problematic because they are highly specialized. They are particularistic and unidimensional transactions, and are in potential conflicts with the inner logic of other discourses. So the primary task of ethics committees, in our perspective, would then be to search for discourse collisions. Can these decisions be justified in the light of different universalities in order to do local justice? These questions should not be decided by the law itself. Rather, they provide law with a new task to constitutionalize alternative institutions which infuse a polycontextual orientation into highly specialized discourses in society. One aspect here seems to be particularly important. In order to cope with those collisions, law would have to switch its orientation from the current pluralism of interest groups to a pluralism of discourses, a pluralism of language games. Law should not attempt a micro-political imitation of interest group pluralism as this practice in the larger political arena with changing corporate participants. This would be a mistaken way of their politicization. The decisive question is whether or not in a rulemaking process, which is dominated by only one type of discourse, it is possible to institutionalize competing rationalities via participation rights, demands for information, evidential procedures, and decision-making procedures. Altera pars audiatur. This would mean here that ethic committees would not just listen to different interest groups, but make sure that the dominant economic or medical discourse would not inflict damage on the internal life of other social areas, on the conditions for their proper functioning, and on the integrity of their guiding principles. So these were my two examples of internalization and externalization. We make some final remarks. I think in both cases, we should be resigned to the fact that there are no general and substantive legal principles, no supernorms, no meta-norms, which could ultimately resolve the collision of universalities. Rather, in both cases, the role of law is simply limited to participating in the infinite game of renvoi, played out by closed discourses. Law only does influence this game in a particular way, constitutes it in legal forms, and infuses it with elements of juridical rationality, at best contributes to minimizing destructive tendencies in the collision of discourses. Emil Durkheim could still hold that the threatening centrifugal tendencies of the modern division of labor will be countered with integration through organic solidarity, restitutive law, and professional cooperative ethics. However, today, in a world of radicalized polycontextuality, an integrative role of law is definitely ruled out, if it means that the law signifies governing values, principles, and norms as valid. Rather, law's role is to externally impose internal limits on the unfettered dynamics of a specialized discourse in the interest of other discourses. The current task of law cannot be to reconstitute the lost unity of society, but to designate borders of plural identities, protect them against domination by other discourses, and limit damage from the fallout of discourse collisions. Underlying is a concept of justice for discourses as justice for the heterogeneous. Quotation by Lyotard: justice would be this, acknowledging that the plurality of the interwoven language games cannot be translated into each other, and that they have their own autonomy, their own specificity, which cannot be reduced to one. This is the extension of the old altera pars audiatur from an individual to a social perspective, which finds the plurality of discourses as the central problem of society today. No longer can these conflicts be decided by a central authority. Rather, central authorities are in an intractable conflict with one another. If we insist on such a position beyond hierarchy, justice could be conceived as a relative term, which would not be applicable in one location only, say law or politics, but which would have currency in all discourses. So justice would denote the deeply problematic relation between discursive identity and discursive otherness. However, not from a third-party perspective, but from the unique perspective of one singular discourse in relation to the meaning world of other discourses. Justice then would not be anything specifically legal, something which under current circumstances would still justify a privileged role of law, but a provocation for each discourse. A legal system would respond to the challenge of justice in a double way. It would not only attempt to achieve the internal consistency of law, but at the same time would attempt to reconstruct internally the rationality of other discourses which are involved in the conflict. Justice, seen in this way, would put modern law under a demand which is twofold. The question is no longer only, is law treating what is equal equally and what is unequal unequally, but the question is now also, does the law do justice to other discourses on their own terms? Without doubt, such a justice for discourses has to live from its inception with the certainty of its failure. Principally, it cannot exclude that discourses violate one another. It cannot reverse the fall from grace in the form of a profound social divide, a functional differentiation, anti-fragmentation of discourses with all their self-destructive tendency. Compensatory as this justice is, it can only insist less ambitiously on an ad hoc limitation, reduction, and compensation of the harm which is inflicted by the collision of discourses. Thank you very much.
I have a confession to make. When I first heard of autopoiesis, I went to the Oxford English Dictionary and looked it up, and it wasn't there. I then, at least three times in print, misspelt it. I continued for some time to mispronounce it, so it sounded rather like a new form of dental disease, autopoiesis. As I've come to work with Günther Teubner's writings and have conversations with him in private as well, I've gone to realize that my initial reaction was somewhat parochial, or it's just an internal discourse. And I think that part of what we're witnessing, and I think this is a very significant part of a process, is the reorientation of our own closed Anglo-Saxon jurisprudential discourse to a conversation with, or a reopening of conversation with, continental European thought. And I think that we are extremely grateful to you for, as it were, this major step forward. I have two pleasant duties. One is to invite you all upstairs to a reception on the fifth floor. The second is to express your appreciation of tonight's speaker. Thank you.